Let me tell you, I actually felt the emotion of political hope for a little while last night.
Yeah? Yeah? Why?
Believe it or not, the last few weeks have actually been sort of like, I don't really know how to say this, but I mean, I'll explain what I mean in a second, but I've been sort of like reconnecting with Bernie Sanders. Like, he's been promoting his book, and so he was in the UK and he did this whole media tour. And if you haven't seen any of this, you know, if you like Bernie Sanders, which if you're listening to the show, you probably at least approve of him. You know, I would highly recommend any of the stuff, you know, his media appearances that he did in the UK. He had a wonderful session at the Oxford Union, took some questions from students there. He had a wonderful onstage appearance with Owen Jones. And it was great because, you know, you get to see Bernie like as just kind of like an author promoting a book as opposed to a political actor. And so the appearance with Owen's amazing. Like, it absolutely broke me where Owen begins with this question, which is, you know, it's a perfectly fair question, but Bernie's response to it was incredible. You know, Owen's talking about how, you know, well, you know, there's never been a socialist party in the United States and blah, why do you think that is? And then Bernie just starts talking about the Socialist Party of America and Eugene Debs. And, you know, it's a reminder, you know, it got me thinking about how in 2016 there was, you know, I think when parts of the left were, you know, maybe trying to just be a little bit dismissive of Bernie for whatever reason, you know, because they're, you know, maybe some people were or are kind of very cynical and just, you know, there's like kind of by definition, if anything becomes popular or successful, it has to be bad. It becomes impure. So there was like a kind of a reflex some people had to be like, oh, well, you know, Bernie's program is just the New Deal, or, you know, he's just a sort of populist liberal. Like, there's not really any difference. I mean, God, there were even some people, I mean, this wasn't too widespread, but there were a few months in 2015 where there were like comparisons to Howard Dean and shit like that. And it's like, you listen to Bernie talk about Eugene Debs, or, you know, you listen to any of his remarks throughout this whole UK tour. And it's just like a reminder of something that I think some of us have known for quite a long time, which is that, you know, Bernie Sanders is not a liberal. Bernie Sanders is a product of a deep tradition of American radicalism that goes back to the 19th century. Anyway, that's all just like a very long-winded preamble to what I was going to say about last night, because Bernie was in Chicago doing a rally for Brandon Johnson. Now, I don't know how closely people are following the Chicago mayoral election, but it's actually pretty exciting. This guy, Brandon Johnson, got on. They have a runoff system in Chicago. And Brandon Johnson, who's a former public school teacher, social studies teacher, he, to everyone's surprise, has gotten through to the second round. He's facing off against Paul Vallis, who, as far as I can tell, you know, fucking this guy, Paul Vallis, has a lot of endorsements from Obama world, even though, like, he's gotten money from Betsy DeVos. He's basically a Republican. He seems to just be like the cop candidate. But so Brandon Johnson got through to the second round, and he and Bernie held a rally together. Huge rally. I watched the whole thing. I mean, amazing to see Bernie in campaign mode again. Martin Luther King's son was there. Jesse Jackson was there. It was a really, really moving evening. You know, Bernie introduced Brandon Johnson. He came out, he spoke. I thought he gave a wonderful speech. And, you know, it's a very close election. The election's on Tuesday. It's not clear what's going to happen. The last poll I saw had them tied at 44% apiece, with the likely voters slightly trending towards Paul Vallis. But I had a very good feeling after watching this rally. I mean, it was very, very powerful. And it's just, you know, a reminder that there are times when you lose, there are times when you suffer these horrible defeats, you know, as the left did in the UK in 2019 and again in 2020 in the United States. But there are losses where, you know, you lose and, you know, you've kind of lost for a generation. And there are losses that are just setbacks, and, you know, the thing that was propelling the momentum is still there and is here to stay. And I don't know, I guess intellectually, you know, I knew that, but I don't know, it's quite something else to just, you know, actually like see it and experience it in the form of a rally like this one, which was very powerful, even though I was just watching it over YouTube.
Now, this campaign here in Chicago, like every other campaign, it deals with a whole lot of issues. But the fundamental issue, the deep down issue, is which side are you on? Are you on the side of working people, or are you on the side of the speculators and the billionaires? And I know which side Brandon is on.
Yeah, it's hard when the opposition sometimes seems so forceful. What happened with Jeremy Corbyn last week in the UK was very difficult to watch.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, actually. I wanted to talk about that as well. You know, so obviously, this has been a long time coming. Keir Starmer has been talking about teeing up this, expulsion of Corbyn for quite a long time. So this was not a surprise. The vote on the Labour's National Executive Committee, which made it official, is not a surprise. And I have to say, I was a little bit irritated for a few days by some of the responses I was seeing from people on the UK left to it, because they seemed rather pedantic. People were pointing out over and over again that this motion, which expelled Corbyn, or rather, made it so he couldn't stand in Islington North as a Labour candidate again. They didn't ask the Islington North Labour Party, which, by the way, has come out with a statement in support of Corbyn. But, people were pointing out this motion didn't have anything. It didn't have any of the, didn't have any of the allegations about, anti-Semitism or anything like that. All of the pretexts that they've been using, all the things they've been using as a cudgel, there was none of that. Instead, basically, the argument was, he lost the 2019 election. Which, if you want to follow that logic, it's like, okay, I guess Ed Miliband should be expelled from the Labour Party for 2015 and Gordon Brown for 2010, et cetera. But I couldn't really figure out why people were making this argument. And I have to say, I just didn't have all the information in this piece that my colleague Dan Finn wrote for Jacobin. It's called Keir Starmer's Case for Excluding Jeremy Corbyn Gives Damp Squibs a Bad Name. This has put in context for me why people were doing this so much. Dan writes, a motion that Starmer brought before Labour's National Executive Committee discarded all the usual charges against Corbyn from his inner party opponents. There wasn't a single word about the Equality and Human Rights Commission report of 2020, Corbyn's response to it, or the issue of anti-Semitism in general. We can only take this as a backhanded confession of failure from Starmer and his associates. After years of intense scrutiny and high-octane rhetoric about Corbyn's supposed moral failings, they were unable to find anything, literally anything, that they could use in a motion that had to be fireproofed against a possible legal challenge. The campaign against Corbyn is a low-grade political B-movie that might aptly be called the incredible shrinking narrative. First, the EHRC report made no mention of the Panorama documentary episode, Is Labour Anti-Semitic?, that was supposed to constitute a damning indictment of Corbyn's leadership. Now the motion to exclude Corbyn makes no mention of the Panorama allegations or the EHRC report. When it comes to the crunch, there's no there, at least not when you might have to defend your accusations in a court of law. So it's a much longer piece, and if people are interested in this, I would recommend you read it. I think Dan does a really good job laying everything out, but that's the kind of essential point for me right there, and it's something I hadn't really understood when I was seeing all these responses on Twitter. I kept thinking, why are people doing this? I mean, of course, they're just crafting any pretext. There's no point trying to pick apart the logic. This isn't a rational argument. They're just trying to purge him because they want to purge everything that he represents, and there's no point pointing this out. But I don't know, with that added bit of context that the motion actually had to be fireproof against a legal challenge, it makes sense why people are pointing this out so incessantly. And I don't know, it's pretty encouraging. They know that they don't actually have an argument here that actually holds up, so they just have to manufacture something instead. And of course, you can pick apart that as well. I mean, Corbyn got, he got about as many votes in 2019 as Tony Blair got in his third majority government in 2015. He got, it's a better result than Gordon Brown, it's a better result than Ed Miliband, etc., etc. But this is, I think, the really encouraging thing in an otherwise bleak development. Like, their case is so flimsy, they actually can't even make it. And, Corbyn, I think, will run as an independent, and I think he'll almost certainly win. He's been elected by Islington North 8 times.
And if the Islington North Labour Party has made this statement in favor of him, I mean, presumably somebody is going to run for Labour in that riding, and presumably they'll have the backing of the Central Labour Party. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, what they'll probably do there, just what they've been doing in other constituencies. I mean, they're being very heavy-handed in a lot of constituencies where they're basically just saying, they're basically just imposing candidates, and then like the whole local constituency organization will just resign in protest. But they don't care about that, because these are people who really would rather have have a party with like 50,000 members on paper that really is like only a few thousand members who are active and is almost entirely controlled or is entirely controlled, you know, by a handful of party staff. They would rather have that and then, you know, maybe get to have a Labour government once every 20 years when the Tories have just like squeezed a little too much blood from the stone or whatever and their poll numbers drop. They would rather have that or just live under Tory governments in perpetuity than have a government like the one that they prevented from coming to power in 2017. I mean, it really is like a vision of politics that is, I think, fundamentally post-democratic. You know, it is not even, I mean, you know, some people have said, they're finally completing the transformation that Tony Blair started of, you know, turning the Labour Party into a sort of bourgeois liberal party. And it's like, I get why people are saying that, but I almost feel like even that's giving it too much credit. I mean, the goal here is just to turn it into this kind of post-democratic formation, yeah, entirely controlled by party staff and like completely unmoored from any kind of deep philosophical commitments. Like the only structuring commitment is repudiating the left. And like, I don't know, like if there is a government led by Keir Starmer, it'll probably just end up being like a fairly socially conservative centrist party that maybe spends a little bit more on public services than the Tories. But like, even that might be too optimistic. I don't know. Anyway, there's also been some speculation that Corbyn could run for mayor of London, which I think would be very exciting. Obviously, this is about a lot more than him, you know, just him as a person. But I have to say, you know, I was very moved by, you know, the way that he responded to this. I mean, he's just, you know, he's on picket lines, he's out in the street, he's protesting, you know, the government's treatment of refugees. He's doing what he's always done. And it's pretty remarkable to see, given what he's been put through by the worst people on earth.
We celebrate a day of peace, a day of harmony, a day of joy we all can share together, joyously.
Well, before we get to our movie on this episode, I want to hash out just on air a personal conflict that Luke and I have been having lately. You know, you can't have a partnership like ours for as long as we've had it without occasionally disagreeing, without sometimes, but the thing is, we're transparent here. You, the listener, are part of the creative process. And I just want to put this on the table, out in the open, and hear what you guys think. The Star Wars prequels. Luke wants to talk about them on this podcast. I don't want to talk about them on this podcast. And I would like to have just a brief exchange of views on this and maybe hear what the listeners have to say. Now, I think the case for talking about those movies is self-evident. They're bad. And my case for kind of not wanting to talk about them is several pronged. One,
you're self-conscious that people on film Twitter might disagree.
Yes. Yes, actually, that's a fair accusation. No, I mean, here's the thing.
Do you really want to do this?
Yeah, yeah.
I think you're opening yourself up here.
I'm totally fine with doing that. I mean, again, I'm all about transparency. I'm all about honesty. What I know is, and this has escalated after the recent sequel trilogy has come out, the Disney Star Wars films, which, can we agree, like, Rise of Skywalker is worse than anything George Lucas ever made.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, our two episodes, I think what we did, The Last Jedi, that
correct.
Was our very first ever Patreon episode.
That's right.
Still a personal favorite.
And Rise of Skywalker, you had a mental breakdown on
air. I mean, like, I think that was more disassociative than, like, a bad acid trip. Like, I experienced ego death watching that movie.
Yeah, and you look at those movies, and those movies have made the prequels look better. Simply by virtue of the fact that they are one insane rich man's bizarre, like,
oh yeah,
those prequels don't either formally or otherwise follow the template of the classic trilogy. Visually, I mean, Attack of the Clones.
I mean, it's so funny because they're prequels and yet all the special effects are like 25 years ahead. And so they don't, it doesn't look like the before time at all, does it?
Not at all. And if you were to watch them in the 1 through 9 order, which
it's ridiculous.
Well, in fact, I think George Lucas has made the case for watching them 1 through 6. He thinks you should watch them that way, but it's
sorry, I'm just thinking about that clip in the there's that like really stupid documentary we watched one time. Was it called Empire of Dreams? Fuck the prequels.
Oh yeah, Empire of Dreams.
Let's do Empire of Dreams, where he comes out. I think, you know, in my head this happens a million times, and I think I'm just like borrowing that from one of the Mr. Plinkett videos, but you know, the Red Letter Media things, but where, you know, he comes out and he's like talking about the prequels, and he's like, it's like poetry, you know,
it rhymes. Yeah. Well, yeah, Empire of Dreams. There was one that was on the New Hope DVD. I think that's what Empire of Dreams was, where it's all about the making of the first Star Wars. And if you know anything about the making of Star Wars, you know it was a somewhat troubled production. And it positions it almost as this like Randian story of this heroic creator.
It's Les Blank's Burden of Dreams. That's what it is. It's positioning George Lucas as Fitzcarraldo, like, dragging the boat up.
Beset by naysayers on every side.
He's dragging the boat up the mountain, but it's so amazing because it's actually accidentally a piece of meta commentary about how the only reason the original trilogy worked at all is because George Lucas and his insane ideas were reined in by smarter people.
Yeah, that's the subtext. The accidental subtext.
He wanted it to be a parable. He wanted it to be like some heavy-handed ass parable for like the Empire as collectivism or something. He wanted Luke Skywalker to be an alien with two heads, you know?
Right.
Come on, man.
Right, but then in, you know, the prequel trilogy comes out after his wife has divorced him and married the architect who built their house. So he's sitting in the study. Again, if you know anything, you know that he wrote those prequels in his study.
Inside a literal palace of infidelity. Architectural monument
thinking
to infidelity.
A Jedi can never know love, you know? And he makes those bizarre movies. And Attack of the Clones was quite an innovative film because it was, I think, the first movie that was entirely shot digitally, at least.
And it looks great.
I mean, I'm just saying, I don't understand it myself, and maybe somebody can explain it to me, but when I go on Letterboxd, I see all these insane people who look at those images and say, this is the second coming of Murnau. This is a man who is playing on some next level with his image making.
All right, well, you know, since there is a disagreement
between us here,
I mean, let me just say,
tepid disagreement, because I'm kind of on your side.
I think that, like, I'm kind of surprised at this rank cowardice on your part. You're talking about, like,
cowardice?
Oh, yeah.
I'm saying this on mic.
No,
brave.
There's this, like, Praetorian guard of letterbox reviewers, and they're going to come and, like, murder me on Twitter if I say that Attack of the Clones is a bad movie.
Okay, but here's the other thing. If we do the other thing, which is just to bash these fucking movies and say, oh, it's so lame, I don't like sand, blah, blah, blah.
Uh-huh.
That's so boring. It's been done so many times. Mr. Plinkett, etc.
Okay, well,
I've done that many fucking times.
Okay. Well, I have a third way, okay?
Oh, thank God. I'm always looking for one.
Like Keir Starmer and Tony Blair, I have a third way when it comes to the George Lucas prequels. Look, I think that to me, there's a little more to discuss. There would be a little more to discuss than just the fact that they're bad. I mean, I think they are bad in interesting ways, and I think they're bad in interesting ways that are germane to this podcast, because they are films that, you know, sort of come out in the 2000s, and they have this very sort of ambient, like,
only a Sith deals in absolutes.
Right.
Do you remember that? Yeah.
Is the Sith George W. Bush? Like, is the fucking United Nations Galactic Senate, whatever it is that Congress doing the post 9/11,
this,
you know,
is how
war authorization
dies.
Yeah, with thunderous applause.
Yeah.
Right. Are they pro-democracy films? You would think so. And then there's like that really funny exchange between Natalie Portman and Hayden Christensen where he's like, what I don't understand about politics is why don't just all the smart people get together, decide what's best for the people, and do it? And she's like, well, that is what we do, but the problem is the people sometimes disagree. You know?
Yeah.
What are the politics there? I don't know. I don't think those films really have politics. I think they're an extremely confused exercise in a madman doing like fan fiction about his own fan fiction.
Okay.
And that,
you know,
interests me. Also, did you know that Star Wars Episode One has friend of the show, past and I'm sure future guest of the show, Greg Proops?
Oh man, I bet he plays like the smart alien.
I think he's, if you remember during the pod racing scene, there's like this weird...
Now that's what I call a podcast. Sorry, Freudian slip.
Yeah.
There's one word that I've said 10 times a day, every day of my life for the last 8 years. And then there's another word I've never said.
Yeah. No, I think during the pod racing scene, he has, there's like that alien where it's like a two-headed one. But anyway, I'm pretty sure that the English speaking head is Greg Proops.
All right. You know, I'm kind of coming around to this. The one I would like to watch is Attack of the Clones.
So I think that that's an intriguing proposition for two reasons. The thing is, I actually do think The Phantom Menace, I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say it holds up, but I actually think that it's like kind of a real movie.
It feels more like the first trilogy does.
Yeah. And, you know, I kind of think that Lucas maybe was onto something a little bit with this idea of what if we sort of begin the film with this, you know, this obscure conflict on a planet that no one really cares about. And, you know, it's just kind of this, peripheral system. I still don't really understand. Like, doesn't really make any sense. Like, what the fuck is the Trade Federation? And what, like, you learn in the opening credits something about, like, you know, it has to do with the taxation of trade routes, which, like, shouldn't that be the Galactic Senate doing that? Why is that the Trade Federation? What the fuck is the Trade Federation? Anyway, doesn't matter. But that one's closer to being a real movie. The thing about Attack of the Clones is that, like, many parts of it are actually embarrassing to watch. I mean, whatever the fire planet is, I think it's not Myanmar. It starts with an M. That's a country. No, I'm just, I can kind of half remember it because it's a map. It was a map on Star Wars Battlefront 2 that my brother and I used to play a lot. Not a very good one. But yeah, there's like a scene where fucking C-3PO is like, his head's getting carried around by a little bat or something. There's a scene that's just like out of like a video game with a terrible frame rate where like Natalie Portman is like Super Mario style dodging some like things that are coming down from the ceiling on a conveyor belt. It's like deeply embarrassing to watch. But the thing is, it's also so convoluted that, like, I'm actually convinced that the plot of that movie, if you sit down and think about it, does not make any sense. And that interests me because it's like George Lucas took, and I guess I'm kind of just like blowing my wad ahead of the episode here, but it's like, it seems to me George Lucas like sat down to write like detailed background exposition on this universe that he created. And yet somehow he's like taken it so far that the plot doesn't really make any sense. Who's this guy, Master Sifo-Dyas, that goes to the weird water planet 10 years before the movie starts to order the creation of a clone army? This is all part of some plot by Palpatine, Darth Sidious, whatever. He's like, I'm going to make the Jedi Council order a clone army so that 10, 15, 25 years from now, I can take over the Galactic Senate and then play it off against another side that I actually control. Why does he need the Galactic Senate? Why does he need the clone army if he already has, what are they, the Confederacy? He's already got General Grievous. Anyway, man, you can see why I want to talk about
it. And I'm interested in watching it because as
I don't care about any of that, by the way. I just want to get that on record.
As I recall, the movie is one of the ugliest films ever made.
It's terrible.
But it's so committed to that vision. It is so uncompromisingly ugly that I want to watch it with an open mind. I want to think maybe what is he thinking, and can I see through those goggles? So that's the agenda that I'm going into.
All right, so you know, you
next
you,
Patreon episode.
So this was going to be a debate, and I think can we get a little victory sound or something here? I think this is this one to be on points.
All right, well, before we get to that movie, we have a movie for this episode. On the previous Patreon episode, we talked about Guy Madden, the great Canadian auteur, one of our favorite Canadian artists, let's say.
Definitely.
Now we're talking about a movie that I teased a little bit on that episode. I brought this movie up, and I do think it deserves the full episode treatment. It is 2015's Bring Me the Head of Tim Horton.
Here I am, lying in the dirt, broke, flat broke, down, out. A lowly, unpaid, deepest background extra, playing a slain Taliban soldier, surely the pinkest of all the Taliban soldiers, in Paul Gross's big-budget Afghanistan war epic, Hyena Road.
Hyena Road.
I've just been asked to hide my pink hands in my pants so they won't be seen by the camera, some 2 football fields away. I'm lying in the dirt in the middle of a Jordanian desert, by the way, about a 100-hour camel, car, and plane ride from home. It's gorgeous here, but what of it? Everything about my visit is gross.
And you can watch this on Vimeo, right? It's only a short film, about half an hour, and it's we'll include the link.
So this film is directed by Guy Madden and co-directed by Evan Johnson and Galen Johnson, should mention that. I saw this film for the first time in 2015 at the Toronto International Film Festival. Madden and Johnson's feature film, The Forbidden Room, also premiered at that festival, as did Paul Gross's big-budget Canadian war epic, Hyena Road. I mentioned this on the last Patreon episode, but you have to understand, Paul Gross is the closest thing we have to a domestic movie star here in
Canada. Yeah, he's an institution.
And he doesn't appear in movies all that often, but when he does, they are big super productions, movies that cost $10 or $20 million, which is a big budget for a strictly domestic product. He used to be on that TV show Due South, where he played a Mountie. He was also on the cultishly beloved CBC comedy Slings and Arrows. That's kind of the legit credit that he has, the one that people kind of go to bat for. But he's best known, I think it's fair to say, for movies like Men with Brooms, the war epic Passchendaele, which is, I'm sure, being shown in a 10th grade history class right now.
Yeah.
And this one, Hyena Road, which I did see, completely vanquished from my memory, but it's a thriller about Canada's involvement in the Afghanistan war. I, again, don't remember it, but I imagine we're in some murky gray area, I think it's fair to say.
Probably, I mean, it, you know, I haven't seen the movie, but it's probably one of those scenes where, you know, like somewhere in Act Two, you know, one of the characters delivers a monologue where they say something like, "Is this what it all comes down to? Cut and run?" You know, something like that.
But, you know, have you ever considered, Luke, that war is hell? And what, well, are we, what are we fighting for? You know, I thought we knew what we were fighting for, but, you know, the longer we spend in this desert, I wonder.
Yeah, Afghanistan, folks, is a land of contrast.
So this film, Bring Me the Head of Tim Horton, was commissioned as a making-of documentary. It's supposed to go on the DVD. Now, I have an interview here with Guy Madden and Evan Johnson in Bomb Magazine from the time. They were interviewed by Steve McFarlane, and Guy Madden explains, "Paul Gross and I met at some really extremely boring Canadian Broadcasting Corporation hearings where a mutual acquaintance of ours was lobbying for a new TV network, and we were brought in as the token filmmaking talent." He continues, "When I met Paul Gross at those hearings, we hit it off in the super stifling bureaucratic atmosphere. Then I suggested, out of sheer jealousy at the size of his budgets, that maybe we could earn a few bucks just to put some bread on the table by shooting a making of. He was up for it because he's crazy. He was like, 'You know, my biggest fear is that we're actually alike. He's always quipping and willing to fail, willing to go up there, swing for the fences, and just strike out. I'm a guy who's more likely to just slap out a batting average with no extra base hits, but we've always got these things going." So Madden being a little self-deprecating there. "So we hit it off, and he liked the idea of us doing this, though I think less as the opening night of Hyena Road came." That's where our true differences came about. "He has a huge military background. All I did was just play guns as a kid. We're Canadian. We hadn't been in a war until this involvement in Afghanistan. I've been a peacenik my whole life, a smug peacenik at that. He's not. He's something else. We're different from each other." And then he continues, "It finally came to a point, resembling a boil, towards the very day that Tim Horton came out. I think all is fine now. The boil burst. It's over." Now, when I saw Bring Me the Head of Tim Horton at the festival, the Paul Gross film and Madden's feature film, The Forbidden Room, both had, you know, theatrical screenings, big premieres. Bring Me the Head of Tim Horton was played in the lobby of the TIFF Bell Lightbox on a screen, like a piece of gallery installation. And an article in Film Comment from the time called Sabotage by Nicholas Rapolds begins, "Even by the debased standards of gallery installations and lobby art, Bring Me the Head of Tim Horton was displayed under subpar conditions at this year's Toronto International Film Festival. Looping on a flat screen affixed to one of the Lightbox Theatre's lobby support columns, this collaboration between Guy Madden and Evan and Galen Johnson competed for attention during my morning visit with the imminent arrival of Johnny Depp for the Black Mass press conference next door."
God, I don't even know what that movie is.
It's not worth looking into. "As photographers jostled on the line to get in and ticket buyers milled about, the left field making of about the Afghanistan war film Hyena Road was barely even audible from the tiny bench that sat between the screen and an opposing wall a few feet away. Perhaps Madden could appreciate the peripheral presentation. He certainly sounded amused in an interview we did a few days later, because his film also exists alongside a piece of Ersatz Hollywood bombast. Ruppold is referring to Hyena Road there. You know, I often have cause to bring up that quote that ends Barry Lyndon, you know. It was in the reign of George III that the aforesaid personages lived and quarreled. Good or bad, handsome or ugly, rich or poor, they are all equal now. And, you know, when I look back at that tiff, you know, Hyena Road, I'm sure it's on a DVD being sold used at a gas station somewhere. Black Mass, likewise, you know, probably rotting away on Tubi right now. And, you know, Bring Me the Head of Tim Horton, Guy Madden just uploaded it on Vimeo. They're actually all the same now. You know, one got the fancy premiere, one was shown on a screen in the light box, and, you know, here we are.
I disagree, because I think this film is absolutely incredible. It is a piece of guerrilla filmmaking. Guy Madden basically terrorizing Paul Gross. I had so much fun watching it. It is so funny.
Well, if I can conclude my point, they're all equal in a certain sense, and yet, who had the moral victory in the long run? You know, Hyena Road cost $15 million or whatever, totally forgotten. This movie cost $10,000, I don't know. And, you know, we're watching it and we're loving it, and ultimately it's had something important to say.
And we're going to popularize it right now. We're going to make this film the beloved national institution that it deserves to be.
So Hyena Road was set in Afghanistan but shot in Jordan.
Yeah, shot in Jordan. You know, I guess the king, you know, who's obviously solidly pro-Western, you know, he probably has like generous tax credits he gives you or something.
Madden is quite blunt in his narration about his reasons for doing the film, saying that the feature project he was working on has spiraled out of control, gone over budget. I guess we're not sure the full extent to which he's telling the truth or not, but I think we can surmise that Madden is doing this for the money to some degree. Madden is kind of going around with his camera. You know, he's apparently been given free rein on the set to shoot whatever. He's filming while the movie is shooting. He's shooting behind the scenes. He's shooting when the vice president of Cineplex, which is the corporation that basically has a monopoly on theatrical film exhibition in Canada. That's not too much of an overstatement to say. I mean, they are a very, very powerful theater chain that accounts for, you know, a vast majority of the box office in Canada. The vice president of that company is on the set and he's delivering this like inane walk and talk for, I don't know, the Cineplex pre-show about, hi, I'm here in Jordan on the set of Paul Gross's Hyena Road.
Folks, do you like explosions?
Later on, we catch a little audio of him that Guy Madden has surreptitiously recorded of him saying like, so we're at Cinecon and we've got Ben Stiller and he's got just a few minutes to record something for us, so we've got him. But then Melissa McCarthy and Sandra Bullock come out and the photographers are going insane, and while he's saying this, Madden is photographing some like local extras who are just like standing around on the set in this really stereotypical Middle Eastern garb. So in his narration he's quite blunt about the differences between himself and Paul Gross. He calls Gross the great Canadian populist. He refers to Gross as making a digestible cinema.
I came here because I was broke. My own film project had gone years into overtime. I needed money badly. I thought enviously of the budgets the great Canadian populist gets for his movies and came up with a bright idea. What if I offered to shoot the making of doc for Paul? Maybe Paul would be flattered by my interest and I could get some quick cash so I could finish my own project. I'd put a Trojan horse inside a Trojan horse. I'd fly halfway around the world, only to replace all of Paul's gorgeous Jordanian locations with Canadian landscapes, swapped into my green screen backgrounds.
He notes at one point that Gross's sets are catered with lobster and clams, whereas he relies on coupons for the local pizzeria. I'm reminded a little bit of the movie Crimes and Misdemeanors, you know, the film that the Woody Allen character makes of the Alan Alda character, who's like positioned as like this ultimate showbiz hack.
Yeah, Paul Gross, Alan Alda explaining, you know, remember, if it bends, it's funny. If it breaks, it's not funny.
Much of the midsection of Bring Me the Head of Tim Horton is Madden off to the side, just showing us the footage that he shot of various scenes while Paul Gross is shooting them. And it's sort of like almost a hostile takeover of Paul Gross's movie, taking Gross's images and compositions and sets and landscapes, rendering them askew.
Yeah, I was saying to you while we were watching the movie, it's kind of like what, you know, Vic Berger does, where you take some kind of found footage and then you just sort of dial up the reality 10 or 15% such that what's revealed is a kind of hyper reality that actually captures something, you know, beyond the foreground of whatever image you're seeing. And in this case, just reveals how unbelievably corny and unserious this movie is. Like, it's this sequence, which I'm sure in the film is like this epic, you know, battle sequence or whatever.
All the troops, all the Canadian troops running in formation, shooting,
fighting guys with AKs or whatever. But then he's like replaced all the bullets with these little like lasers going like boom, 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 and all these like corny sounds from like a soundboard. He changes all the color, so it's this kind of like ludicrous, like surrealist technicolor. And it becomes just such a funny scene to watch. Like, Will and I were laughing out loud.
Later on, there's a scene that he shoots of these two Middle Eastern characters, and who knows what the scene is in the movie, but what we see is, you know, you don't get the audio, but just two guys, one comes up with like a head, you know, it's been beheaded. And Madden, who at several points in the narration talks about the ethics of depicting violence, just puts a black box over the prop beheaded head. And you see these two characters, you know, without the audio, doing this incredibly corny acting and this incredibly corny tableau, this lawless hellscape land where these two non-white people are reduced to savagery, basically. And Madden and the Johnsons in post-production, you know, amp up the colors and add this sort of pseudo Ennio Morricone spaghetti western sound.
Oh my God, the music was killing me. This sort of like Muzak that's layered over. And again, it just makes everything you're seeing, which is supposed to be totally harrowing, just like laughable.
And in that scene with the two Middle Eastern men, like the camera is showing Paul Gross behind the camera looking at his phone and sort of smiling.
Yeah, just out of character.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a little bit of, you know, forgive me if this is like a hacky analog, but there is a little bit of, you know, F for fake in this movie or something like that. You know, I do think Madden, you know, at various points he has these monologues that do seem, you know, somewhat serious, just about, you know, the craft of cinema, you know, the politics of the camera, the politics of depicting violence, that kind of thing. And I do think he's not just taking the piss out of Paul Gross, which, you know, he's certainly doing, and the result is very funny. But I think he is also kind of trying to say something. He is trying to just use Paul Gross as sort of a shorthand for maybe the artificiality of cinema in general, but particularly the artificiality and contrivance of like paint by the numbers, big budget blockbuster cinema.
Well, one of the things about Paul Gross is he consciously seeks to be the middle of the middle of the middle. He consciously seeks to be Canada's populist filmmaker. I think if he were here, he wouldn't disagree with that. he makes movies for a wide audience, and, you know, he courts all the big investors, you know, and his war movies. I mean, I remember Passchendaele quite well. It's
right. Brought to you by Scotiabank.
It's a movie that seeks to satisfy any possible viewer. Like, if you think World War I was the war that turned Canada into a country,
from colony to nation.
That's right. We stepped up by sacrificing our entire East Coast in a pointless war.
I guess Vimy Ridge, did that engagement happen during Passchendaele, or was that during the Battle of the Somme? Was Passchendaele a subset of the Battle of the Somme? I don't remember.
What I know about Passchendaele was that it was a horrible, muddy slaughter where the East Coast, 100 years later, is still not recovered from it.
Like, not to take us too far off course here, but I always thought it was funny, because I am actually pretty interested in military history, that when people talk about the Western Front and the First World War, which is mainly what you learn about, you know, if you like grew up in North America or probably like Western Europe as well, I just love the idea of like delineating specific battles. I mean, I know that makes sense in a way, but I love the idea that there's like a functional difference between like, oh yeah, like there was like 6 weeks here where we, in this one part of Belgium or like northeastern France, where like 50,000 men a day were just like thrown into the meat grinder because some like Austrian archduke got assassinated by a Serbian ultra-nationalist. And then, I don't know, for some reason like 20 million people have to die. I just love the idea of like delineating like between like one part of mud that was like bombed to shit versus another one. It makes sense with other wars. I always thought it was funny with World War One, but I always just thought it was funny for when it comes to World War One, at least if we're talking about the Western Front.
You know what else I was taught in grade 10 history is that, so for the First World War, when Britain entered the war, we automatically entered the war. Like, there was no debate. We were a colony of Britain. So we proved ourselves. We proved that we were a real country in that war, to the extent that when the Second World War came along and Britain entered that war, I think we
declared war 3 days later.
That's right.
Yeah.
3 days, or maybe it was a week. It might have only been 3 days, but it was not the same day. And that was a bold assertion of our national status. But anyway, you know, there's that famous quote that Truffaut made that I only ever see brought up when people are trying to contradict it. You know, that quote about it's impossible to make a truly anti-war film because depicting war in a film is inherently exciting and thrilling. I mean, you know, it's a quote that basically I only ever see brought up to say, oh, but actually Come and See is an anti-war film, or, you know, this or that. But, you know, to be generous to that quote, Paul Gross's movies are what Truffaut was talking about there, where it's like these movies where, you know, it's like the moral
ambiguity of war. Look at this exciting, look at this boom, 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 boom.
And they buy into the idea ultimately that, like, well, this is important. You know, this war, love it or hate it, our nation was defined by this stuff. And we proved ourselves a nation, and you got to hand it to those brave men and women out there who are fighting for us, and who knows why we're over there, but at the end of the day, et cetera, et cetera. And if you're Guy Madden, who is also one of Canada's national artists, who takes Canada's national identity as one of his main subjects, and is very serious about that, you can imagine him looking at the Paul Gross movies and saying, well, what the fuck is this? I mean, this is disgusting. And this is who gets the $15 million? This?
The contempt that is like just dripping from his voice in the monologues are so funny. And there's also like a lot of little flourishes that are very like Guy Madden-esque that I think further contribute to just like the guerrilla filmmaking quality of this movie. Like, I just love the idea that he was like, I'm gonna make like a behind the scenes documentary about your movie. And then, yeah, he basically just did an act of terrorism to Paul Gross. Like, there's that part early on where he's decided that he's gonna use all of his, or like, you know, the Guy Madden character, Guy Madden as Guy Madden, decides that he's, you know, going to basically take all of Paul Gross's locations and like set them in Canada.
He carries around a green screen behind him.
Yeah.
And he was going to make a satiric point about, well, we're making this Canadian movie in Jordan. What if we superimpose actual Canadian landscapes onto this? But then the joke is, oh, I didn't bring a big enough green screen.
So he's just walking around with this green screen, like across this Jordanian landscape, whereas the green screen, yeah, has like, you know, mountains on it or something. It's very funny. There's also some kind of My Winnipeg-esque stuff in this movie. If you haven't listened to that episode, do check it out. One of my favorite films we've talked about on the podcast, Guy Madden's My Winnipeg. The episode was called Guy's Winnipeg, appropriately enough. That's obviously a kind of surrealist, autobiographical mockumentary, I think it would be fair to say, something like that. And there's a bit of that in this movie as well. Like, Madden talks about his love of hockey as a kid and how much he loved, you know, the classic players, Tim Horton, Guy Lafleur, and then he just randomly puts in at the end of the movie, like the film closes with this like clip of, I guess, Guy Lafleur on some kind of probably like vinyl release that kids could get, where you get to learn about like how to take a shot in hockey from Guy Lafleur, and he's just giving these like very pedestrian instructions about shooting from the backhand is the hardest because of the curve of the stick, but because the idea of shooting has a very specific meaning in, you know, a film about film
and also a film about warfare. I think we're also encouraged to imagine like the firing of a gun.
Absolutely. So yeah, I mean, he's creating like kind of another like little piece of found art here to close out the movie that also manages to be, you know, autobiographical. I mean, this is one of the things that's so incredible about Madden, is that there's a lot of sort of absurdism in his films, and yet for me the implication of them is always extremely earnest, even when they're also managing to be incredibly funny. Like, Bring Me the Head of Tim Horton somehow manages to be like a half-hour practical joke by a serious filmmaker who takes his art very seriously and thinks about Canada in a very serious way at the expense of a much hackier and more commercially successful filmmaker. it manages to be that. It manages to be like, you know, Guy Madden punking Paul Gross in Hyena Road. But I feel like it also does have these earnest autobiographical flourishes. And I feel like
Guy Madden makes some very morally serious points as well.
Yeah, he's making a real movie here, which, you know, considering what he's working with, is pretty incredible.
I'm thinking again of my teen years when my big brother bought me a bottle of Guy Lafleur cologne. Maybe Lafleur. Maybe the combination of one of my obsessions with another of my obsessions will provide the contrast, the counterintuitive jolt we require to pry the already tragic image of death up from mere relief into something the eyes and heart can...
Hi, I'm Michael Kennedy. I'm in Ichabod, Jordan, on the set of Paul Gross's upcoming movie, Hyena Road. Now, the movie's being shot in Jordan, but it's actually set in Afghanistan. It follows a Canadian platoon as they fight for their lives. Stay tuned. We're going to go behind the scenes.